From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley, filling in for Nell Larson today. We have three segments to cover today, Chris. Mm-hmm. The first topic that we're going to go over is landscaping and weed management, specifically trout landscaping. And we'll speak with Sarah Jo
Trout Dinkins. Friendly landscaping.
Trout friendly, sorry. I'm henching you guys. Give me a break. Okay. We'll speak with Sarah Jo Dinkins, the owner of Ecology Bridge and project manager for the Cooperative Weed Management area, and Elizabeth Cohen, who is the assistant professor for Extension Agriculture and Natural Resources at Utah State University, who are in the studio with us today.
Perfect. Then we'll speak with Jordan Clayton, who heads up the Utah Snow Survey. We'll get the latest on the impacts of yet another major snowstorm to hit northern Utah, I believe the 237th of the year. We'll talk not only snow, but how much water is expected to run off and begin filling our creeks, streams, lakes, reservoirs, and possibly our basements. You don't want to miss this conversation. Finally, we'll speak with Sarah Goking, a biological scientist with the U.S. Forest Service. She'll talk about some recent research that says that thinning forests will not help restore the Great Salt Lake, and in fact, could make things worse. That's in the third part of the show. Environmental awareness and education. That's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us. Welcome to This Green Earth, the weekly talk show about our relationships with and impacts upon the environment. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley, pinch hitting for Nell Larson today.
Thank you for doing so.
Absolutely. I'm excited about these topics.
Well,
let's dive right in.
Yeah, dive literally. because our first topic is really interesting. It is about, well, the trout-friendly landscaping. So there's a few words that you don't typically
put together
yep. in a single sentence. But we're gonna explain all this to you, or we'll have a couple guests to help do that. Sarah Jo Dinkins, who is the owner, proprietor, president of Ecology Bridge.
Correct.
Right, Sarah Jo? And project manager or manager for the Summit County Co-op Weed Management Area. And also Elizabeth Cohen. She's the assistant professor for Extension Agriculture and Natural Resources at Utah State University. Thank you to the two of you so much, actually, for coming in this morning.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for having us.
All right. Sarah Jo, toss up the first obvious question. Give us the definition of trout-friendly landscaping.
Well, I think the first question everyone asks is, what do trout have to do with landscaping? And we're not building a bunch of pools, although Mother Nature may do that for us this year. But we are not stocking trout in your yard.
Okay.
Quite honestly, it's a program that helps people understand that what you do in your backyard, in your property as a whole, will run downstream. And it will affect the aquatic species in our natural waterways, including trout, who we love the trout.
Sure.
Everybody loves trout.
Trout, all aquatic species.
All aquatic species. But trout is a good keynote for key species for what we're doing here.
Let's pause there real quick. What is a keynote or key species like that? What does that mean?
Well, I guess if you're talking scientifically, unless Elizabeth wants to answer this one, if you're talking scientifically, it's usually a species that provides some sort of function that's important to the ecosystem, or the loss of that species is an indicator. So they may be indicator species as well. So if we're starting to see our fish die back, in this case, that's our indication that either we have water quality issues or we have water quantity issues, because if our streams are too shallow, they become extremely warm, and the oxygen levels that are important for fish deteriorate. And so that's where, if you saw the 1 year that in East Canyon Creek we did have die off of fish, and we come close
and that was
every
due
year.
To a water quantity
shortage
issue.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But we have both going on here in Summit County.
Okay. Well, let's say this spring and summer, let's assume that we're not going to have a water quantity issue per se, but we may have a water quality issue, right? With increased runoff.
Yes.
Brings the potential for increased particulate matter or physical, biological, and chemical consequences.
Plus, we've had so many snowstorms this year that people have been putting a lot of salt out.
Okay.
I mean, because nobody wants to fall down. And the salt can have an effect on water quality.
Sure.
And is associated with harmful algal blooms and all sorts of other fun things.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
The salt can, okay. Yeah, well, real quick aside, we oversalt.
We do.
We do.
It's not necessary. You know, we live in a mountain town. We all have four-wheel drives, and we know how to drive in snow. Okay, there's my...
The soapbox always comes out.
But one of the other things that's really important for people to understand is that our storm sewers are not filtered or treated in any way. So I don't know about y'all, but I saw some melting happening over the weekend, and it was just running down my street into the stormwater drains, and that goes straight into whatever your nearest creek is.
Right. So
what you do in your yard and on your street and what your neighbors do, and if there's a construction site that's not putting up erosion control, that ends up straight in your stream.
And again, that can be particulate matter, you know, mud, dirt. It can be chemical matter, like this salt. And also oils, road oils, petroleum-based products that flow down, and it can even be biological. If there are homes that have septic systems that get overwhelmed, and that's going to happen this spring.
Or dog
poop. Yeah, for sure.
Don't get him started on that again. So people do. Matter here in this circumstance. We all matter, and everything that we do does make a difference.
Right.
So what are how would you prescribe to work with this trout-friendly landscaping? How does this work? Can you give us how people get started, what they should do?
Yeah, so it's a certification program overall. And I should say it came out of other ski areas and been very, very successful. So Sun Valley, Idaho, Big Sky, and then also Jackson Hole have done it. And they've done it for different reasons. Mostly one of the reasons, right? They either had low water quantity or they had quality issues. Lots of algal bloom issues in Jackson Hole. But in Summit County, of course, we have both issues, right? And so we've been really lucky to be able to piggyback on their programs. And what they found is that a certification program is really helpful. One, because we like to show off when we're doing good things, right? And so people who become certified get these signs that they put in their yard. And I don't know where our funding stands. Hopefully we'll be able to do the ultimate signs we're looking for, but they are these amazing metal signs. The design was actually done by a local artist here of a cutthroat trout. And it literally is the trout. It's not like some ugly sign.
It's tacky.
Beautiful. It's beautiful. So you get to put that in your yard. But in order to get there, you need to become educated, right? And so we're offering a free training on April 17th at night, 6 p.m. It'll be online. And what they'll learn there are a lot of the techniques, a lot of sort of the background information to understand why you would do those techniques. So we're talking about stormwater. One really good example of what can be done is if you're near a stream or if you're near gutters, keep the vegetation within, 5 feet, I believe it is, dense. Keep it really dense. Don't cut it. Keep it tall because that acts as an amazing filter strip. So as that storm water moves through that vegetation, it's pulling that particulate matter out and some of the chemicals out. And so it's little things like that, you know, that we'll be teaching about, or how to change what you do simply with mowing. We're not saying get rid of grass. We're not saying that, right?
Okay,
because
good.
When grass is used appropriately for a good function, it's important to keep around. You just have to do it properly. And a lot of people can make a big impact by raising their mower blade. Typically we see 2 inches. Why do we have it set at 2 inches? Because we don't want to mow very often and we want it to look perfect. But if you set it at 4 inches and use mulching blades, you can leave all of those grass clippings on your lawn. And I think that equates to 1,000 pounds or something like of that of nitrogen.
It's a lot.
And it makes a big difference. Then you don't have to do that fertilizing. Right? So one, you've increased your your nitrogen levels naturally, and two, you're increasing your soil carbon levels, which after a few years of doing that, you can hold a 2-inch rain event. Imagine a big rain event in the early spring that normally would run off your property. Now you have this sponge in your soil that's sucking that up, mm-hmm. which means it's then available to those plants as things dry out much longer and your irrigation needs go way down. So there are really some simple techniques.
Also, if you raise your mower blade and your blades of grass are longer, they're going to lose a lot less water to evapotranspiration, so you're not going to have to water as much. So it makes the grass itself more water efficient.
Okay.
And the weed person in me can't help but say a really thick lawn makes it hard for weeds to grow. So keep it nice and thick and nice
having
and
good
tall,
soil.
And having good soil.
Okay. So you touched on a lot of things, but these are all some of the asks or requirements, and let's say, of becoming trout friendly certified.
Correct.
There's going to be a list of things that you have to do, and maybe some requirements met before you receive that beautiful yard sign.
Correct.
Of a trout.
And we have
okay.
We have three different levels of certification, and
oh. So I get three different levels of trout?
You get bronze, silver, or gold.
Okay. So, right. I'm sorry. I don't know how to make a joke. So real quick, what are the three different levels?
So the first level is bronze, and Sarah Jo and I really wanted to make it accessible to everyone. A lot of people have the impression that you have to rip out your existing landscape
right.
and put in all these water-wise plants in order to conserve water and improve your soil health and all these things, and you don't. You can just change how you manage your current landscape and make a huge difference. So we wanted to make sure that that bottom level of certification, the only fee that anything in that list that has a fee is the soil test, and that's $30.
Let's talk about that.
And so if that's a barrier, if somebody wants to participate in the program and they can't afford the $30 soil test, we have vouchers, so they could just contact me.
What is the soil test going to tell me?
We recommend the routine soil test. So that'll tell you your soil type, like your texture. So whether you have a clay or
silt,
and that tells you what your irrigation schedule should be. Because if you have a clay soil, you should water for a long period of time infrequently. And if you have a sandy soil, you need to water. You might have to water every day, but just a little bit. Because it drains out really mm-hmm. quickly. So your soil texture is really important. It will tell you your phosphorus level, your potassium level. Mm-hmm. What else?
Nitrogen.
It doesn't tell you nitrogen.
Oh, it doesn't?
No.
Oh, that's so important.
We just assume because nitrogen cycles so quickly in the soil, and it is kind of all over the place. So you can add on a nitrogen test. It's not really necessary. We just assume that you need to add nitrogen, and if you put on the soil test form what you're growing, like it's grass, vegetable garden, shrubs, orchard, then the analytical lab will tell you how much nitrogen you should add for that particular purpose.
And that nitrogen via fertilizer?
Yes. And then you can pick whatever kind of fertilizer you would like to use.
Okay.
But the point is that most of our soils in Utah have really high phosphorus and potassium levels. And so most people don't need to add those nutrients. And those nutrients can be really problematic if you apply too much and they end up in our waterways. So most people might just need to add nitrogen. Or if you're mulching your lawn clippings, you might not need to add very much at all.
Wow. Okay. So that soil test does tell a lot.
It does. It does.
Are the two of you available to help homeowners try to understand and parse this?
The Extension office, people can always call me if they have soil testing questions.
Okay.
I have soil augers, which are a little they're like probably an inch and a half in diameter, and they help people sample their soil easily. And so we have instructions on how to do that. And how to send in your soil sample.
Okay, let me reintroduce you. That is Elizabeth Cohen. She is the Assistant Professor for Extension Agriculture and Natural Resources at Utah State University. And we also have Sarah Jo Dickens, owner of Ecology Bridge, and the manager of the Summit County Co-op Weed Management Area.
Yeah, Summit CWMA. We'll say
Summit
it.
CWMA.
Make it easy, Summit CWMA.
And we're here talking about trout-friendly landscaping. It is a program to help homeowners, businesses, anyone that owns a lawn, a yard, to manage that yard in such a way that it is friendlier to the environment, so to speak, in terms of the amount of nutrients that might run off it, the pollutants that might run off it. We haven't even gotten to herbicides and insecticides. We'll get to that in a minute.
Thank you.
And how that ultimately works its way into our creeks and streams and wetlands and could have an impact on aquatic species, heck, all species, land species, birds, everybody, eventually gets to impact. But we like to use trout as the indicator species for this program, in a sense. So that's what we're talking about.
Yeah, and it sounds like that there is a huge educational component to this either way, that people can have a greater understanding of their impacts on what is happening and that we all take part in this. And you had just mentioned the herbicides and you kind of, Sarah, had this very visceral reaction to that. Why is that?
Well, you know, I think as somebody who works in noxious weed control, I do, be honest, get accosted a lot about herbicide and herbicide use and what the impacts are. I mean, there's a broad spectrum of potential impacts, right? And often there's a lot of research that comes out linking things to herbicide or correlating them. And I often have to work hard to explain that a correlation doesn't mean causation. But beyond all of that...
Yet.
Right.
We'll continue.
Continue to do research. Okay. Right. Because there are a lot of things that we expose ourselves to on a daily basis that are actually more toxic, as far as we know now. Right.
Sure.
But research is always expanding. So knowing that there are potentials, right, for some impact, how do we best deal with it? Reduce herbicide use as much as possible. I use a whole toolbox. Right. What we want people in their landscapes to understand is, well, a couple of things. If you're doing it yourself, hand weeding of biennial and perennial weeds can be fairly easy at the scale of a home landscape. Pretty easy if you know what they look like. Now, when we move on to something that is a perennial that comes back year after year after year and has a very extensive root system, we're dealing with a different animal. You're not going to get the roots just by pulling. And so there are non-chemical methods that can be used to reduce. Rarely do we see these completely kill those weeds, but they can be used for reducing. So we'll teach people that, you know, there's instances where just putting mulch, 4 to 5 inches of mulch in an area can suffocate out those weeds because they can't germinate without the sunshine, right? There's goats. I don't know if local, you know, landowners, homeowners are going to be renting goats, but certainly our municipalities are interested in using goats. Our ranchers on the east side are starting to integrate rotational grazing and utilizing their sheep specifically more for weed control. Though it was happening before, now they're doing it more aggressively. So there's a lot of options for weed control, and it all starts with knowing what weed you have so that you choose the proper method and you choose to treat it when it's actually sensitive to that method. So tomorrow morning, 9 a.m. at the Public Health Department at Quince Junction, we will be holding a free to anyone who's interested. Get there at 9. We'll be talking about noxious weeds in general. What are annual, what are biennial, what are perennial, why do I care? And how do I identify them and how do I control them? Our Summit County Weed Supervisor, Dave Bingham, will be there, and he'll be actually talking about biological controls. And so these are insects that can be used, typically not used in somebody's backyard because the population of weeds isn't big enough to support the bugs. But very often used on our ski slopes and out in our rangelands.
Okay, so that's Wednesday.
Tomorrow, yep,
at 9 a.m. at the Department of Health, the Summit County Department of Health?
Correct, building? At the Quinns Junction.
Quinns Junction, mm-hmm. Okay. And that's where you learn all about this program, how you can sign up.
Well, that's how you'll learn about noxious weeds.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, and then the program is April 17th.
For trout-friendly landscaping.
April 17th.
And that's online, and anyone can join.
Correct.
You just need to register ahead of time, and you'll get the Zoom link when you register.
And how do people register for it?
If you go to the Summit County Extension website, it's usu.edu/summit. It's on our website.
And then people can just go online.
It's an Eventbrite.
And register. You get your Eventbrite. You get your Zoom link. You go on there. And you take this training, and you had said that USU Extension will come up and take a look and make sure that you did everything properly. Is that
correct? Yes. We are planning to ask the Master Gardeners, because they, as part of that program, they have to complete 40 hours of volunteer work. So we're going to recruit them to help us go out and check people's certifications when they say that they're ready.
Right. So you check them, verify them. They get bronze, silver, or gold as a result. But then is there an ongoing annual checkup that has to be done to maintain that certification?
Yes.
Right?
It's not a one and done, because right. nature has a way of growing things back, right? And so What other programs have done, and I think we should follow suit because it's been successful. We actually collect the signs in the fall and store them. One, because then they don't get as damaged by winter, but two, because you gotta do it again next spring, oh, wow. right? But if you've done it well the first time around, it's less work in the spring. And that brings up another topic.
Sure,
of
a few more minutes.
Who is doing your landscaping? Is it you or is it a landscaper? I would say the majority of landscapers follow a pretty similar program for most of their properties because they've seen that it works. It works, but is it necessary is often the question. And so for anyone that has a landscaper, and I do have a landscape business, if you were to come and say, hey, what are you using, when and why? I would be happy to tell you. Because it's important for you to understand, you may not know that herbicides are being applied every couple of months to your turf grass. That's pretty common. It comes with the fertilizer.
Ah.
And people aren't aware of it. People also don't know just how many nutrients are being applied and whether or not they're necessary. So if you can get the soil test and bring it to your landscaper and have a conversation. If you have a landscaper, tell them maybe to check out the training on April 17th if they're not comfortable with these more sustainable methods. Because really, the landscape industry also has a huge capacity to make an impact on sure. changing how we impact our waterways locally by what we're doing.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, we all need to understand that all of our actions have consequences too, and none of us want to see our indicator species taking the hit for our actions.
But if I'm a commercial landscaper, isn't it my job to come to your home as much as possible to mow it, then to fertilize it, and then to apply chemicals of various sorts? That's my job. That's how I make money. I need you to keep this blade at 2 inches. I'm going to mow it at 2 inches. If I keep it at 4, maybe I don't have to mow as much. There is an economic incentive of a lot of landscapers
Correct,
to
but,
be at your place as much as possible.
Well, and I think that begs the other question of how do landscapers make money,
okay,
right?
Right.
And so, yeah, maybe if you raise the blade to 4 inches, they got to come back more frequently. So it actually is a benefit to them to do it the right way that way. I think it's also important for people to recognize that if you're getting an educated landscaper, that they're going to cost a little bit more and be willing to pay a little bit more
okay.
to make sure it's being done
right.
correctly.
Like again, quality comes with a bit of a premium cost. But wait a minute. If I grow my grass at 4 inches, the landscaper has to come back more often? Is that because the grass is healthier and more robust and growing?
It just gets to that threshold where you're like, whoa, that looks shaggy.
So,
I mean, you could keep it at 9 inches if you want. We could plant some
bunch
grass,
your HOA.
Make it natural. If you make it natural, actually, your HOA cannot stop you from doing it if it is a drought-tolerant bunch grass species, and you're mixing in other drought tolerant species according to county and I think now city law. The HOAs can no longer stop you from doing that.
All right, we got to wrap up. So many more questions. Real quick though, April 17th is the training. Again, the website?
It is usu.edu/summit. And that's the Summit County Extension website. And you can also call our office or email us if you have any questions.
You better give me the number.
Oh, I don't.
Okay.
While she's getting the number.
You get the number for us. You can't just say call us and not give us the number.
It's 435. Are you ready?
435. Go ahead.
336.
336.
3236.
3236. And Elizabeth, you're going to answer the phone?
I am. That's my actual...
That's Elizabeth Cohen, Assistant Professor for Extension, Agriculture, and Natural Resources at Utah State University, and Sarah Jo Dickens with Ecology Bridge.
Can we say one more thing that's
real
coming?
Real quick.
Okay. So May 1st, for those people who want to make this transition, May 1st, the Utah State Pollinator Program is going to be opening their application. What the application will do if you are granted, it's not a grant, it's not funding, but it's locally sourced seed that has been grown out to support pollinators. So it's natives that you typically can't get if you go to a big box store. We will also be opening our stipend program, which will help with some funding for a limited number of folks. So get on online. You can follow up with Elizabeth with the information we already provided, and any questions people have.
All right.
It'll also be on our website later today.
Yes.
Perfect. Thank you.
All of that information. There's a lot of information to be had, but thank you so much.
Thank you so much for joining us. I think we'll have you back maybe in a couple months to get an update on how things are going.
Would love that.
Once we can see the ground.
So we'll see the ground.
maybe not.
And quite
get
possibly,
your rainwater barrels out.
The fish swimming in our yards, literally. All right, Sarah Jo, Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Thanks for having us.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, the weekly talk show about our relationships with and impacts upon the environment. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Claire Wiley, filling in for Nell Larson today.
That's right. Thank you for doing that. And our next guest is Jordan Clayton. He is with, among other things, why do people have titles?
I'll tell you what. We have a lot of long titles in this state, but they're all well-deserved, well, and his are as well.
Yes. Well, Jordan, I was going to say, you were the Utah Snow Survey and snowtail findings and research. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. Again, it's been a while.
Yeah, you don't have to call me any of those things. I just go by Jordan. Thank
just
you.
Jordan. All right, Jordan. Tell us what
There's
is
a lot
going
to talk,
on.
But I'm
it's
sure.
been a few months since we've had you on. Record-breaking stuff, in a word, correct?
Correct. And you're... this is unbelievably timely to be talking to you right now, because it was actually only about 5 minutes ago that the math came in, if you will, on our current snowpack data. And as of today, we have currently, we have just broken the all-time record ever measured in Utah's snowpack. So we broke the record at our snowtail sites about a week and a half ago. We knew that we were ahead of all previous records for the amount of snow that we had in Utah based on our snowtail weather stations, which were, you know, really, really kicked off around 1980. So we were then comparing with 1952, which obviously predates snowtail. But back in those days, the only way to do this was manually, and folks would go out once per month and measure what are called snow courses. And based on the 1952 data, we hadn't quite surpassed that snowpack level until today. And as of today, we have broken the 1952 record. So we started measuring those snow courses right around 1930 or so. So going back through all of, our recorded measurements for the state of Utah, we have now exceeded all previous records. We're looking at the most recorded snow in Utah.
Okay, so I want to make sure that this record is with respect to snowpack, or is it also with respect to, say, total inches of snowfall?
No, that's a good clarification. We don't monitor snowfall per se. So when I talk about that, I'm principally talking about the amount of liquid water content. We call it snow water equivalent in our snowpack. And so, yeah, when we go out and measure those manual snow courses, we're typically only measuring what the liquid water content is of the snowpack and also what the snow depth is at those locations. And, again, those have been measured since the 1930s.
Okay.
Now, of course, Snowtell measures other things, at those automatic weather stations. But
right.
But no, we don't typically report on snowfall, but a lot of other agencies do.
Yeah, and again, these are locations around the state that are data is collected from them, and then some type of single number is generated from that.
Right, right. So back in 1952, there were 61 of these snow courses that were measured. Again, these were measured just once per month at that time. We've since converted 47 of those into snowtell sites. And so in order to make a fair comparison with the current data, we didn't just use all of our snowtell sites. We have 138 snowtell sites in the state. And so it would be kind of not a very good apples-to-apples comparison to use all of those when we only did it, at 61 locations in the first place. So 47 of those 61 original locations are still measured today, but were converted to snowtell sites.
Right.
And so we just use those numbers, those 47 sites that have overlap. And when we do that, again, as of today, we've broken that record.
Is it possible that the record can continue to be broken? We're not done.
Although
there is a warming trend coming, unbelievably, it can still snow, and that record could the existing record right now, today's record, could be broken again.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay.
We're anticipating an even higher value tomorrow because what we're doing right now is we're really only looking at the once per day numbers that we get from all of our snowtell sites. And so when I talk about today's values, that's as of midnight last night. Now, we know we've received more snow since midnight, so that'll add to today's total, which we'll assess as of, midnight tonight. We're anticipating that number will increase. You're right, we are seeing some melt, particularly in low-elevation sites in southern Utah. But really, what's been quite fascinating about this year's, there are a lot of things that have been fascinating about this year's snowpack. One of them is that our mid and high elevation snowtell sites throughout the state have not started losing any snow water equivalent at this point. Again, we've got a few low elevation sites around the state that have, but I don't expect that statewide snow water equivalent number to come down until we get significant warming, which could come by this weekend. But in the next couple of days, I think we're going to maybe continue to build upon this record that we've broken today.
Now, historically, Jordan, you have been coming on the show over the past year or so, and the information that you were dispelling to us was not always that great, and we were looking at these really low water tables. What does this mean for us then? And people get excited and think maybe we're back, but what does this really mean for our state?
Yeah, that's such an important question, and one that I sort of struggled to answer in a short way. So please just cut me off if you get to a point where I'm going too long on this. But there's no perfect way to say whether or not we're kind of back to where we want to be, if we're out of the drought. There's a lot of different ways we can approach this question. One of the things we can do is we can look at where our reservoirs are at and see what we expect to fill and which ones are not going to fill. We are anticipating, based on the current snowpack and what we're modeling for snowmelt and runoff from this snowpack, we are anticipating that all of our small and medium-sized reservoirs will fill, and most of the large ones as well. So that's outstanding news, and obviously that's critically important for our surface water supplies used for agriculture, municipal purposes, everything. What we're not anticipating filling is the really, really large reservoirs, like, for example, Bear Lake, some of our downstream buckets, if you will, that are even larger, like the Great Salt Lake or Lake Powell. Chances are very good that, again, we'll fill up a lot of those upstream buckets, so to speak, all those reservoirs that feed into those larger water bodies. Mm-hmm. But we've got a long way to go before we start thinking that we're back on track when it comes to, like, the Great Salt Lake or Lake Powell. We're going to need another above normal winter to really keep the trend going for those larger water bodies. Another way you can try to answer your question is to look at how much we've rebounded in terms of our annual precipitation. So I've been calculating our deficits going back to 2020. Each year we've been in the hole for all of our major basins when it comes to how much precipitation we've received relative to normal for that basin. And when you add up all those deficits each water year, you can get a sense for how deep in the hole we are, you know, from a precipitation perspective relative to where we should be. And then we can use this water year, which started on October 1st, and it doesn't end until September 30th, but we can use projections forward based on current data. And if you do that exercise, you know, based on data that I looked at a couple days ago, and we're going to update this, but based on those projections, we're looking at about a 70% decrease in those precipitation deficits for most basins in the state. So we've cut that deficit, you know, by about three quarters, more or less. It still means we've got a little ways to go, but that's just an incredible boost. Now, some basins in the state, that deficit is gone, so they're already looking at a potential surplus. But for the majority of basins in the state, including the statewide total for precipitation, we're cutting that deficit by around two-thirds to three-quarters. So that's great progress.
All right, I got a listener texting me. He wants to know numbers. What was the previous record, whatever, you know, the snowpack number? And what is the new record, and what will it be tomorrow?
Tomorrow it'll be, yeah, no, I can't say that because right. I don't know. The previous, it's a hard question to answer, and I was skirting around it because we get into the weeds a little bit on this. So if we look at all the snowfall sites in the state, which is the graph we have on our webpage, we have 138 sites in the state, and we have to immediately narrow that down to 114. Because we don't have, some of those sites are so new that they don't have normals. And so we have to only include the ones that have been around for at least 10 years. So we get down to 114 sites for the analysis. And if you do that math, our previous record was 28.8 inches back in 1952, which again isn't perfect, and I'll come back to that.
No.
And then as of today, it's 29.0. So we've broken it by 0.2. If we just look at the
29.0, that mean that there's 29 inches of water equivalent at any one of these locations, or is that the average water equivalent? I'm just trying
average.
To get a visual of this. Okay.
Yeah, 29 sorry, so inches. That's the average. So that averages all those 114 snowtell sites that I just mentioned. You know, and there's a really tremendous range there. We've
yes.
got some that are obviously well below there. The Ben Lomond Peak snowtell site up in northern Utah is our current first place site. It's got over 80 inches of snow water equivalent up there, which is just an amazing amount of water. Doing the same thing for those 47 sites that were measured in 1952 and just looking at those numbers, the numbers are a little different, but the trend is the same. 29.9 inches in 1952, and based on those same locations as of this morning, 30.1. So again, an increase of 0.2 over the record.
All right, we got to wrap up, but I do want to talk real quick. This snow and all this water equivalent, it's not like it's all going to come pouring down out of the mountains. Out west, in a very dry, arid environment, a lot of it evaporates. A lot of that snow will sublimate. What do you think does the most, what evaporation or melting condition most worries you? Well, what scenario? Is it really suddenly really warm days, or is it a big rain event, or is it just sunny days and with humidity? Which one of those will potentially produce more runoff than another?
Yeah, that's a really hard question to answer in a general way. But I could say, if, in terms of, you know, things that concern me, if we stay cool and wet until, you know, late May or something like that, And when we have a really high sun angle getting into late May, early June, we suddenly get hot and warm, particularly if it's hot, warm, and humid, because actually water vapor can introduce a lot of thermal energy into a snowpack.
Mm-hmm.
And we get really warm, sunny days, and then maybe throw in a little warm rain on top of that. That could be a serious problem.
Okay.
It just all depends on the rate of melt.
Right. Okay. We got to leave it at that. Website people can go to?
Yeah, just type in your favorite search engine, Utah Snow Survey, and it'll have all the information there.
Utah Snow
Survey. Thank you so much, Jordan. We appreciate it. We're always glad to get some good news from you. And it sounds like we're doing all right, but we also have a ways to go.
Yeah. We have a new chapter that's about to unfold.
And that's what right.
We'll touch base with you hopefully next month to see how that's unfolded.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
All right. Thanks, Jordan.
Thanks, Jordan. Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Claire Wiley.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. And joining us for the final part of the show is Sarah Goking. She's a biological scientist with the U.S. Forest Service Rocky Mountain Research Station. And she's here to talk about an interesting study. Sarah, first of all, thank you for joining Claire and me on This Green Earth.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, this story caught our eye out of the Salt Lake Tribune. And just the title was enough. It was like, we got to learn more about this. The title of the story was Thinning Forests Won't Help Restore the Great Salt Lake and Could Even Make Things Worse. So I guess the first question, Sarah, is who thought that thinning forests would benefit the Great Salt Lake? And how would that work?
That's a great question. And I think that most people that haven't taken at least a shallow dive into forest hydrology might not be aware of the long history of forest management experiments that did involve usually clear-cut harvesting rather than thinning.
Mm.
But these studies over the past 100 years or so did often find that water yield increased following the removal of forest cover.
Mm.
Within the past 20 years or so, as we started seeing lots of mortality across the West, we started also observing that stream flow or water yield did not always increase following those mortality events. And that led to our investigation and some others kind of going on at about the same time that found that in really dry places like Utah, instead of getting an increase or even no change in water yield, you sometimes get a decrease. The reason why the wetter places would get an increase is because you have fewer trees taking up water from the soil and transpiring,
right. And
also fewer trees intercepting the snow. If you have like a spruce or a pine in your yard, you've probably seen how much snow it can intercept. And a lot of that ends up sublimating directly into the atmosphere. In Utah, though, where our environment is so dry, evaporative demand is so high that we basically trees serve a different function in these dry environments where they're providing shade for the snowpack. I know you were just talking about how fast runoff might occur this year.
Right.
And a major hydrologic value of trees here is shading the snowpack and shading the soil to slow down how fast water or snow evaporate or sublimate into the sky.
Yeah. Another aside, I mean, this article also stated that in the Uinta Mountains near us, bark beetles have more or less taken 25% of the trees have been died or have been damaged beyond repair, let's say, due to bark beetle infestation over the last, 5, 6, 7 years?
Probably more than that. It's about the last 15 to 20 years.
Yeah. So they're a big reason why maybe the thought was like, well, these you have all these dead trees. And of course, with dead trees, there's that potential to there's that relationship between dead and dying trees and fire. And so the thought was, well, we need to thin these forests to manage potential fire situations. Is that is that one rationale behind the thinning process?
It is, and that can be a benefit
right.
for thinning in places that are likely to experience fire. Utah's forests aren't historically or even prehistorically, they didn't burn very often in most places. So usually that is a less needed or successful management strategy. But in a place like the Uintas, where, you know, we had a history of lots of logging in the late 1800s and early 1900s, you know, most of the railroad ties for the Transcontinental Railroad in our part of the world came from there. So there was a lot of logging. Then there was the creation of the Forest Service and implementation of policies to put out fires. So after those early logging, those harvest events, and then the change in fire policy, that kind of set us up for some pretty severe beetle epidemics. And then those in turn, as you mentioned, they do set us up for higher fire risk. Mm-hmm. And often it's not like we can prevent all fires from happening. Some fires can be really good for removing those excess fuels, but some thinning treatments, and I know this is the case along the Wasatch Front, you know, where we have dense forests with a lot of mortality close to where people live or recreate. And there, the goal might be to just reduce the risk of a really severe catastrophic wildfire.
So I want to circle back again. Apologize if I missed this, that the thinning the forest would not only, at least the article or what your research suggests, because you're quoted in this article in the Salt Lake Tribune, that it not only would not benefit the Great Salt Lake by bringing more water to it, it could actually reduce the amount of water that would go to the Great Salt Lake?
It could. If done in the drier watersheds or in such a way that increases the total amount of evapotranspiration, which is evaporation plus transpiration, mm-hmm. That could reduce the total amount of water making it to the Great Salt Lake. So we did a study of 159 watersheds all across the West, including 13 in Utah.
Oh.
And we found that the driest watersheds often did produce less runoff after forest cover was lost. And the reason for that is because even though you don't have as many trees taking water out of the soil and transpiring,
right.
You also, those same trees, they were providing this value of shading the snow, shading the soil, slowing down wind. And it kind of comes back to what really drives evaporation. Evaporation increases if you have warmer temperatures, more wind, and lower humidity. And in Utah, our humidity typically is so low that even if the transpiration from those trees is, you know, it no longer occurs, evaporation actually might go up.
Yeah.
And so we might see less water making it downstream.
Wow. Okay. We have to wrap up, but no doubt, lots of moving parts to this. To our ecosystems, right? And the physical and then eventually chemical and biological relationships between all these moving parts. What's the next level of research you're doing?
The next level of research, I think, is looking at where and how can we do thinning that might seek to address this risk of severe catastrophic wildfire
right.
and do it in a way that we can optimize our snowpack and optimize the length of time that we keep that snowpack on the ground. As your previous guest mentioned, we want a nice slow runoff. We don't want it all at once. Also, the longer we keep that snowpack on the ground in the forest, the less likely trees are to experience drought stress and potential mortality because of that.
Right. Well, no doubt, Sarah, this is going to be a fascinating spring and summer
yeah.
with respect to like, the melt, the runoff, and then again, also always go back to it, the physical, chemical, and biological impacts associated with record level melts like this.
And your research is so important. And if people wanted to learn more about this and what you're looking into, how would they do that, Sarah?
I'm sure that they could go to your website first and see my name.
Yes.
And then just if they Google me, they'll find me pretty easily. Or the website Tree Search. So Tree Search, all one word, .usda.gov is a great place to look for any research done by people in the Forest Service, all freely available.
Absolutely. Really interesting study. Sarah Goking, biological scientist with the U.S. Forest Service Rocky Mountain Research Station. Thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Thanks for having me, Chris and Nell. I appreciate your attention to the topic.
Oh, thank you. Okay, we're out. We are out of time. We have to wrap up.
We had a great guest today. We are grateful for all of them for coming on and always illuminating us about what's going on out there in our environment.
And I will kind of quickly work backwards here that all the interviews will be posted later to the station, KPCW station website.
That's right.
Under This Green Earth. But let's thank our sponsors and underwriters who make this show possible. They include Recycle Utah,
Utah Open Lands Conservation Association,
Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties,
San Francisco Design,
and of course, listeners like you. You can email us your thoughts, comments, and ideas for topics and stories you'd like us to cover to the email thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
That's right. We are going to go out to NPR News in just moments. Thank you for listening.